Today is Tuesday, May 18th, and you are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, fighting continues between Israel and Palestine.
Compared to in Gaza, buildings are being hit all the time, and hence you have thousands of people that are injured and 200 people who are killed.
Plus, Afghan president readies for war as U.S. troops leave.
The key to political dialogue is that the Taliban accept that the future political system of Afghanistan is based on elections.
Also, WHO chief accuses Western nations of vaccine apartheid. Israel continues to bombard Gaza with airstrikes on Tuesday as more than a week of fighting between Israel and Hamas showed few signs of abating, despite intense U.S. and global diplomacy to stop the region's fiercest hostilities in years. Soon after dawn, missiles struck two buildings in Gaza City, sending plumes of thick smoke into the air. Militants in Gaza fired rockets early that set off sirens in southern Israeli cities, sending thousands running for bomb shelters. The Israeli military said late on Monday that Hamas and other Palestinian groups had fired about 3,350 rockets from Gaza, 200 of them on Monday alone, and that Israel air artillery strikes had killed at least 130 militants. Gaza health officials put the Palestinian death toll at 212, most of them civilians, including 61 children and 36 women, since hostilities began. At least 10 people have died in Israel. Amid seemingly fruitless diplomatic efforts to stop the violence, the top U.S. military officer, Army General Mark Milley, warned the violence could spread. International Edition's host Steve Miller spoke with reporter Orly Hapern in Jerusalem about the ongoing conflict.
There was one building that was hit, a direct hit today in the southern part of the country, in the city of Ashkelon. But compared to Gaza, buildings are being hit all the time, and hence you have thousands of people that are injured and 200 people who are killed. So the situation is very bad in Gaza. There's a problem because Israel, since May 10th, is not allowing, it's closed the borders. So fuel has not entered the strip, and there's almost no electricity, running water. It depends on also electricity to operate the power. So there's little running water, there's fuel supplies are low, and you have about 10,000 refugees, people whose homes have been demolished or partially, making them uninhabitable. Some of those people are staying at UN schools in the Gaza Strip. They've been converted into shelters, and the situation is quite dire, not to mention that there's corona. So you have hospitals that already have corona patients. So it's a very difficult situation in Gaza right now.
Early on Sunday, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for an immediate ceasefire. The United States and other countries are also calling on both sides to de-escalate. And the images of the bombing taking place in Gaza are going out around the world. And a lot of people have expressed enormous amount of concern about the death of children. How are Israelis responding to the calls for ceasefire and the reports of children being killed in the conflict?
I spoke with some Israeli friends today, and they said, well, you can't compare. You simply can't compare. The killing of those people and of those children, the ones that are not a military activist, it was an accident, and accidents happen. They don't see that as a reason to stop firing on the Gaza Strip. And in fact, today there were calls by mayors of councils in the south of the country around the Gaza Strip, Israeli councils. They called on the government to just continue and to eradicate terror and to harm Hamas. Now, those are very vague demands. I mean, what does eradicate terror mean? There's a whole other aspect to this. All sorts of needs on both sides that need to be resolved, and particularly in the Gaza Strip, which is still under occupation. So you can say eradicate terror, but if the people there are suffering, it's going to come back on Israel. So right now, Israelis are okay, for the most part, with continuing the attacks on Gaza. From the Israeli point of view, they're saying, well, they keep shooting on us, so we need to keep shooting on them.
That's my colleague Steve Miller speaking with reporter Orly Hapern in Jerusalem. The Biden administration continues moving carefully amid the worst Israeli-Palestinian fighting in 7 years. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Moghani reports.
In a call with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, the White House says President Biden expressed support for a ceasefire, but did not demand one. An administration official says that was intentional, amid White House determination to back Israel's right to self-defense. Spokeswoman Jen Psaki says the administration's moving behind the scenes to end the violence.
Through quiet, intensive diplomacy.
But it's under pressure to respond more forcefully. Dozens of Democrats are calling for an immediate ceasefire. Top Senate Republican Mitch McConnell says that creates the false narrative that the two sides are legitimate combatants when they're actually an independent state trying to defend itself against terrorists.
What nonsense.
Sagar Meghani, Washington.
Embattled Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has received a political boost from the fighting with Hamas. AP correspondent Joe Fetterman reports.
The current round of fighting appears to have given a boost to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Just a week ago, Netanyahu was fighting for his political life. His opponents were on the verge of forming a government that would have sent him packing. He had a chance to form his own government after Israeli elections in March, but he failed. The deadline passed. His opponents now have a one-month window to do so. They were very close to an agreement last week when the fighting erupted. Now that there's heavy fighting going on, it's much harder for them to form an alternate coalition.
WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said on Monday that the world has reached a situation of what he called, quote, vaccine apartheid, unquote, during remarks to a virtual Paris Peace Forum event. Earlier, he called on COVID-19 vaccine manufacturers to make shots available to the COVAX vaccine sharing facility sooner than planned due to a supply shortfall left by Indian export disruptions.
I think I would go one step further and say not just that the world is at risk of vaccine apartheid, the world is in vaccine apartheid. As you know, high-income countries account for 15% of the world's population, but have 45% of the world's vaccines. And low and lower middle-income countries account for almost half of the world's population, but have received just 17% of the world's vaccines. So the gap is really huge. So far, we have shipped more than 63 million doses of vaccine to 124 countries and economies. But that represents just 0.5% of the combined population of those countries and economies. The problem is not getting vaccines out of COVAX. The problem is getting them in. So COVAX works. It's the problem is supply.
That's WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus. As vaccine demand drops at home, the Biden administration says it will share millions more COVID-19 vaccines with the world. We have AP Washington correspondent Sagar Meghani again.
The U.S. had already pledged to ship 60 million AstraZeneca doses overseas once federal regulators clear them for use. Now, President Biden says 20 million doses of the three vaccines that are approved will be shared for the first time.
We need to help fight the disease around the world to keep us safe here at home and to do the right thing of helping other people.
He's been under growing international pressure to share doses, even as fewer Americans seek the shots domestically. More than 123 million people here are now fully vaccinated. More than 157 million have received at least one dose. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
Britain lifted many of its coronavirus lockdown restrictions Monday as infection rates have fallen to the lowest level since August. But as Henry Ridgewell reports from London, there are growing concerns over the spread of a new mutation of the virus first seen in India.
Off on vacation. These British passengers arriving in Lisbon, Portugal, were among the first to take advantage of the easing of lockdown rules Monday.
Oh, it's just fantastic. The feeling's unbelievable. We've got sun, we've got the people, the beaches, the bars. Can't wait.
Yeah, it's better than being in any England. So,
woo! A dozen countries have been put on Britain's green list for travel. Travellers from other countries, including most of Europe and the United States, still face mandatory quarantine on arrival in Britain. Pubs, restaurants, art galleries and theatres in Britain opened their doors Monday to allow customers inside for the first time this year. There were celebrations Monday in London's West End entertainment district.
And the West End is back in business.
But not everyone is enthusiastic about the changes.
Most of the people who are going to be going to the pubs are probably the people that are not vaccinated as well, so it does seem a bit risky.
I wouldn't be surprised if there's another lockdown, quite honestly.
Fueling the concerns is the spread of a mutation of the coronavirus responsible for the surge in cases in India. The city of Bolton is a hotspot. The government has deployed mobile vaccination units and has warned that the spread of the new variant could disrupt plans to end all lockdown restrictions next month.
We're in a race between the vaccination program and the virus, and this new variant has given the virus some extra legs in that race. But the vaccine will still, we have a high degree of confidence that the vaccine will overcome.
Scientists say Britain is well prepared for opening up.
All the data indicates that vaccination can prevent severe disease induced by this particular variant. So whilst this variant may well be able to infect folk, including folk that have already been vaccinated, it doesn't appear to result in severe disease. The data is still dribbling through at the moment. But I think the concern is, you know, we still have a large proportion of the population unvaccinated, particularly younger people.
Several European countries are easing lockdown measures. Tourists are slowly returning, offering a glimmer of hope for Europe's battered travel industry. Scientists say the relaxation of rules will inevitably lead to more infections. The question is whether the vaccines are now more potent than the virus. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Afghan President Ashraf Ghani said on Monday his country is ready for war with the Taliban, with the withdrawal of U.S. troops underway. Ghani also said the issue of power may have to be, quote, decided on the field of battle, unquote, if the Taliban gains power and imposes a dictatorial regime. His comments come as heavy fighting between Afghan security forces and Taliban insurgents resumed on Monday after a three-day ceasefire announced by both sides for the Muslim holiday of Eid, officials said.
As far as straight-out war is concerned, we're ready. The key to political dialogue is that the Taliban accept that the future political system of Afghanistan is based on elections. That is the fundamental bottom line. Other things are discussable, negotiable, but if that fundamental issue is not granted, then the question of rights and the question of gains that have occurred in the last 20 years, particularly vis-a-vis women, youth, minorities, all walks of life, will be put into question.
That's Afghan President Ashraf Ghani. Turkey is threatening to go ahead with Russian military purchases despite warnings from Washington. The threat comes as the impasse between NATO members deepens over Ankara's purchase of a Russian missile system. For VOA, Dorian Jones report from Istanbul.
With Washington stepping up its pressure on Ankara to reverse its purchase of the Russian S-400 missile defense systems, Turkish Defense Minister Hulusi Akar this month defended its intentions, dismissing American concerns. This is not an offensive system, Akar said, adding, this system can't threaten anyone in any way where it is deployed. It's not a risk, threat, or danger to anyone, the official said. Washington says the S-400 missile's advanced radar poses a threat to NATO defense systems and calls for its removal. But Ankara has said it's considering purchasing more batches of the Russian missiles. One source close to the government says Turkey has already struck a deal with Moscow. Last month, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken warned Turkey could face sanctions if it bought other Russian weaponry, including additional S-400 missile systems. Concerns over the S-400 have already resulted in Washington's blocking Turkey from modernizing its aging combat aircraft with America's advanced F-35. But Turkish presidential adviser Mesut Çavuşoğlu warns Washington is forcing Turkey only further to deepen its military ties with Russia.
We need 200 combat aircraft. This is the reality on the table. But the U.S. don't give the combat aircraft. And you pressure to buy the Russian combat aircraft. We don't want to buy it. But if the U.S. don't give the combat aircraft, we can buy the Russian combat aircraft. Because we need the combat aircraft.
Analysts predict Ankara will not make any new Russian weapon purchases until a planned meeting between the Turkish and American presidents on the sidelines of next month's NATO summit. İlham Özgel, an international relations analyst who writes for the Duvar News Portal, says the Russian missile purchase is holding U.S.-Turkish relations hostage.
It's standing there as a stumbling block, and it's a kind of a precondition that the U.S. imposes on Turkey. And I haven't seen any other period in Turkish foreign policy history that Turkey has cornered itself to that extent.
Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Çavuşoğlu said Washington should get over its objections, standing firm that Turkey would not reverse its Russian missile purchase. But some analysts predict that Ankara could yet be willing to make a deal if Washington offers concessions. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
This is the Voice of America. A cyclone on India's west coast has killed at least 19 people and damaged infrastructure and agriculture, while heavy rains continued to lash some regions on Tuesday. Spain is facing a humanitarian and diplomatic crisis after thousands of would-be migrants took advantage of relaxed border controls in Morocco to swim or paddle in inflatable boats onto European soil. By Tuesday morning, Spain said around 6,000 people had crossed the border into its enclave, Ceuta, since early Monday. The sudden influx of migrants, most of them from Africa, has deepened the diplomatic row between Rabat and Madrid in the wake of Spain's decision to let in for medical treatment the chief of a militant group that fights for the independence of Western Sahara. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. The World Health Organization reports that COVID-19 pandemic has set back years of gains made in efforts to eliminate neglected tropical diseases, a diverse group of 20 illnesses that disproportionately affect impoverished communities in tropical areas. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Neglected tropical diseases affect 1.7 billion people globally. 40% are in Africa, a continent that encompasses most of the 10 high-burden countries in the world. Over the past decade, the World Health Organization reports great progress has been made in the treatment of many of these life-threatening and debilitating diseases. It notes 42 countries around the world have eliminated at least one disease. However, Mwelechele Malichela, director of WHO's Department of Control of Neglected Tropical Diseases, says she fears a lot of this good work could be undone because of the negative impact of COVID-19. She says the pandemic has caused disruptions and delays in NTD services. She says mass treatment campaigns, surveys of affected areas, and the transport and delivery of medicines have been interrupted.
All the efforts that have been done to control these neglected tropical diseases to bring about elimination in some of the countries will be reversed if the focus is not kept, a good focus on surveillance, a good focus on continued interventions in some of the countries which are nearing elimination.
WHO reports guinea worm disease is on the cusp of eradication, with only 27 human cases reported in 6 African countries last year. In 1986, about 3.5 million human cases occurred annually in 21 countries in Africa and Asia. WHO says yaws, a chronic skin infection, is a disease that can be eradicated in the Indian subcontinent. Malichela cites several other success stories.
In terms of elimination of trachoma, we have Morocco, we have Ghana, and more recently we have Gambia. We have the elimination of lymphatic filariasis in Togo and in Malawi. In Yemen, which is, you know, outside Africa in the Middle East, they have eliminated lymphatic filariasis under very difficult conditions, but they've managed to do it. And that's, you know, very impressive feat.
At the end of January, WHO formally launched a new roadmap aimed at driving progress toward a world free of NTDs by 2030. Health officials consider the roadmap a key piece in ensuring countries build back better after COVID-19 by focusing on resilience and strengthening health systems. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
France says it will cancel $5 billion in debt Sudan owes it, and Germany also offered assistance during back-to-back Paris financing summits targeting Khartoum's democratic transition and Africa's economic rebound from the coronavirus pandemic. For VOA, Lisa Bryant has more from Paris.
The 2 days of high-level talks near the Eiffel Tower in Paris gather more than a dozen African leaders, along with top representatives of multilateral institutions, the European Union and China. Sudan was on Monday's agenda. 2 years after overthrowing longtime leader Omar al-Bashir, the country faces a raft of challenges, as Sudanese activists like Nasreen El-Saim noted in speeches, among them inflation topping 300% and shortages of basic goods. A big chunk of its $60 billion in foreign debt is owed to the so-called Paris Club of major creditors.
Une singularité de votre transition.
President Emmanuel Macron hailed Sudan's transition toward democracy as inspirational, saying the international community was on its side and that the country needed to be supported economically and politically. Sudanese Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok says the country, rich in natural resources, isn't looking for grants or donations, but rather wants the international community to explore investment opportunities. Africa-wide talks Tuesday focus on the economic fallout of COVID-19 that has decimated tourism and other sectors. Last year, the continent fell into its first recession in more than 3 decades. The World Bank estimates roughly 34 million new poor, people living on less than $2 a day in sub-Saharan Africa alone. Experts say COVID-19 has left the continent facing a $300 billion financing shortfall. Ahead of the talks, International Monetary Fund head Kristalina Georgieva told France 24 TV she hopes richer nations will use a planned $650 billion boost in IMF's reserves to help the region power ahead.
We do hear a great deal of concern among the advanced economies of this dangerous divergence. Advanced economies pulling out, low-income countries falling further behind. Why this is not only an ethical concern, it is also an economic concern, because this divergence would mean more insecurity, more instability, and lost opportunities for the world economy to grow.
Oxfam International is also worried Africa is falling behind for somewhat different reasons. Peter Kamalingin, Oxfam's Pan-Africa Program Director, says giving Africa access to COVID-19 vaccines and technology is key.
The second thing, of course, is we are seeing quite a lot of the conditions that the IMF and the World Bank are continuing to give, the conditions on the loans. I think it is yielding into a lot of austerity, and that means a lot, particularly for the vulnerable parts of the population.
The summit, attended by leaders from Rwanda, Mozambique, and Egypt, is also seen as another chance for Paris to broaden its influence beyond Francophone Africa. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
That's Brian Wood of Reuters. The Thai affiliate of Paris-based insurance company AXA says it's investigating a ransomware attack by Russian-speaking cyber criminals that has affected operations in Thailand, Malaysia, Hong Kong, and the Philippines. The hackers claim to have stolen 3 terabytes of AXA's data, including personal health and bank account information of customers. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great evening.
this month, live from the Kigali Arena in Rwanda. The Basketball Africa League begins its inaugural season. Catch the action with VOA Africa. Monday's games tip off at 1200 UTC, 1900 UTC.